Today we will begin reading the Reverend Louis DeBoer's commentary on the Book of Esther, the foreword. This is not meant to be a scholarly book. It is not written by a scholar and is not written for scholars. There are virtually no footnotes. It was written for everybody, from the young Bible student studying Esther for the first time to the busy pastor looking for some insights as he is preparing a sermon on Esther. This is not a critical commentary, presuming a knowledge of the Hebrew and even perhaps of some of the other cognate languages. It presumes that the text is a faithful translation and only resorts to the Hebrew when a specific point is being made that is not clear in the translation. If an alternate translation is better, it may be quoted by way of elucidation, but it is the authorized version that is being commented on. This commentary does presume that you are basically familiar with the Book of Esther and have read it through at least once, as it sometimes refers to later events to cast light on earlier ones. I have used only a few basic sources and sought to spare the reader the details of scholarly debate that may rage over certain parts of the text. My aim was to provide simple and logical commentary on the text that would clarify it and promote understanding. I have not attempted to provide equal commentary on all the texts. Some are so self-explanatory that the reader requires no assistance in their comprehension. Others require considerable comment to bring out the full significance of the text. Other texts may be simple enough to understand, but it may require an entire additional chapter to explore the logical and ethical implications of what the writer is saying. I have sought to provide assistance where I thought it would be useful, but not to insult the reader's intelligence where it is obviously not required. Esther is a marvelous book. It shows that the world is not governed by chance or accident, that we are not the captives of fate and a brute impersonal reality. It shows that there is a God who governs history, working all things according to the counsel of His will. And because He is God, and because He is sovereign and almighty, seemingly miraculous events still happen. And because He is truly the living God, in absolute control of the minutest events in His creation, this marvelous, miraculous tale of Esther is true. As you study this story of God's providence, I pray that the truth of this book will truly speak to you and that you will accept it for what it is, a testimony to God's covenant faithfulness to His people. Chapter 1, Introduction. The story of Esther is an amazing chronicle. There is actually no mention of God in the entire book. And for this reason, perhaps, the German reformer Martin Luther went to the extreme of denying its right to a place in the Scriptures. Yet it is one of the clearest demonstrations of God's providential control of history. It is an amazing demonstration of divine justice manifested in this life. But the book does raise a number of questions. Questions that will be dealt with as they arise. The very first one is, why is there no mention of God? The fact is, there is a consistent reference to God in this book, but it is not by name. The power, the providence, the goodness, and the grace of God, that is God's existence and His attributes, are clearly and consistently manifest in this book. The Bible itself teaches us that God reveals Himself in various ways. These ways include by His creation, by His word as given and preserved in the Scriptures, by His providence, The psalmist tells us that God's revelation of himself through his creation is a universal language that is heard throughout the world. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4. Paul tells us that this revelation is sufficient to establish the existence, the greatness, and the goodness of God, so as to leave men without excuse in the judgments of the last day. Romans 1, 18 through 21. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful. We call this general revelation, but it is specific enough that men will be judged thereby at the last day. We also have special revelation, God's Word, as revealed to us and preserved for us in the Holy Scriptures. And finally, we have God's revelation of himself through his providence. If by his creation he proves that there is a creator, by his preserving and sustaining that creation, he establishes that there is a sustainer and preserver of this world. He proves that he is a faithful, covenant-keeping God who keeps the covenant that he made with mankind in the days of Noah when he made this promise. Genesis 8, 21 and 22. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more everything living, as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. The book of Esther is written revelation of God working through providence. And this record of his providential doings, this revelation of himself through providence and history, is preserved in his word. And although there is no mention of God by name in this book, there are indirect references to his existence, not only by creation and providence, but by acts of worship directed towards him. Both fasting and days of thanksgiving are acts of worship. They are acts of worship towards God in response to the dispensations of divine providence. In times of trial, in days of woe, men resort to prayer and fasting in their appeals to God for deliverance. In times of great blessing and prosperity, in occasions of remarkable deliverance and special preservation by the hand of God, men call for days of thanksgiving. It is fitting, therefore, that in this record of God's special providence, that the only allusions to God are in days of fasting and thanksgiving. The book starts off with, Now it came to pass. This almost sounds like a fairy tale, and reminds us of the familiar phrase, Once upon a time. And the book at times seems to be almost a fairy tale. It is the story of an unknown Jewish girl who becomes queen of the Persian Empire. It is the story of how she delivered her people from seemingly certain destruction. It is the story of how her foster father, once a despised Jew slated for death, becomes the prime minister of the most powerful potentate of that day. Yes, all this does read like a fairy tale. The difference, of course, is that this story is no figment of the imagination. It is true. It is marvelously true. And it records an incredible tale of God's providence towards His people. All this makes the story of Esther a story of joy and triumph that has always been a delight to God's people. The book of Esther is a historical book. Accordingly, it tells us the time, the date, the place of all the events that it records, and it identifies all the main characters, but says nothing of the author. Who is the author? Is it Mordecai? Logical supposition would lead men to that conclusion, but there is no proof. The author was obviously someone who was intimately familiar with all these historical happenings, and the only two people familiar in every intimate detail with these occurrences are Esther and Mordecai. Esther herself is ruled out as the author for a number of reasons, including her sex. That, of course, leaves us with Mordecai, and he is the one that has generally been presumed to be the author, especially by the Jews themselves. Mordecai knew these events as almost nobody else could have, but that does not necessitate that he is the author. It only establishes that it is most likely to have been written with Mordecai's assistance and under his direction. In the New Testament, we have several examples of inspired books supplying a historical record written not by, but under the direction of, those who had personal knowledge of the events. We have John Mark, who wrote a gospel under the apostolic imprimatur of the Apostle Peter. We have Luke, who wrote a gospel and the book of Acts as an associate of the Apostle Paul. Even so, we have to allow the possibility that some godly and inspired scribe at the Persian court under Mordecai's direction may have authored this book. We will never really know in this life. What we do know is what God in His wisdom has determined that we should know. What we do know is that our God is a great God, a sovereign God in control of history, a gracious God who cares for His people, a God who works in mysterious ways His wonders to perform. If we have learned that, then we have learned the most important lessons of the book of Esther. Chapter 2, A Royal Divorce. Esther 1:1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. The story begins by identifying for us a certain Persian king. Who is the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther? All we are told of him is his name and the extent of his kingdom. And even the name is not all that helpful. There are three Ahasueruses listed in the Old Testament scriptures. The one that is set before us in the book of Esther, as well as two more that are mentioned in the following text. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, Daniel 9:1, and in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem, Ezra 4:6. Names are confusing because of the process of transliteration. Transliteration is the process whereby a word is not translated, but simply phonetically carried over to another language, and if necessary, another alphabet. To give an example, I come from a country called Netherlands. This is transliterated into the English as the Netherlands, It means the low country, but is transliterated into the plural form. The French decided to translate it rather than transliterate it, and they call it Les Pays Bas, which also means the low countries. Names are usually transliterated with some exceptions. When they have a particular meaning, they are sometimes translated. American Indian names are a good example. Some, such as Red Cloud, Sitting Bull, and Crazy Horse, have been translated for us into English names rather than being transliterated as Geronimo, Tecumseh, Pontiac, etc. were. Biblical names are usually transliterated even when they have a very specific meaning. Elijah is a transliteration and is not translated as "My God is Yahweh," although his name in the contest with the Baal worshippers had great meaning. But although the concept is simple enough, in practice it has been notoriously confusing. Even the name of God has been affected by this process. Yahweh, the Hebrew name of God occurring over 6,000 times in the Old Testament scriptures, is grossly transliterated as Jehovah. Similar confusion attends the transliterations of the name of our Lord. In the Old Testament, it has been transliterated from the Hebrew Yeshua into the English Joshua. In the New Testament, it has been transliterated from the Hebrew into the Greek, and from that into the English Jesus. This has caused some confusion in passages like this one, Hebrews 4, 8 and 9. For if Jesus had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day? There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. What it really means is that Yeshua, the son of Nun, the successor to Moses, who led the children of Israel into the earthly land of promise, could not actually give them the true rest, but that Yeshua of Nazareth, the Christ, will bring the people of God into their eternal rest. All this should give us a better understanding of the difficulties of sorting out the name that we are dealing with. The Persian form, which would be his actual name, was Keshay Arsha. The Hebrew transliteration from the Persian is Ahashverosh. When it is transliterated into Greek, the Greek form is Xerxes. The transliteration from the Greek to the Latin became Ahasuerus, which when transliterated again into English gives us the name Ahasuerus that is familiar to us from our English Bibles. Since we are part of what is generally called Western civilization and get our history primarily from Western sources, it is the Greek names that we generally have to deal with. Now we can begin to examine these three kings that are called Ahasuerus in the sacred text and seek to identify them. First of all, we need the following chronological list of the kings of Media and Persia that are relevant to this period. 1. Cyaxares, king of Media. 2. Asiages, Cyaxares' son, last king of Media. 3. Cyrus, king of Persia. 4. Cambyses, Cyrus' son, king of Persia. 5. Galmata, a usurper impersonating Smerdis, Cyrus' younger son, king of Persia. 6. Darius, Hystaspes, Cyrus' son-in-law, king of Persia. 7. Xerxes, Darius Hystaspes' son, king of Persia. 8. Artaxerxes Longimanus, Xerxes' son, king of Persia. Now the scriptures tell us that the Ahasuerus of the book of Daniel is the father of Darius the Mede, the last king of Media before the kingdom fell to Cyrus the Persian. Therefore, he has to be Cyaxares. Axaris is practically the same as Xerxes and merely has the prefix Cy or Chi, common to the Chianian dynasty. So it is not surprising that its final transliteration into English would also be Ahasuerus. The Ahasuerus of Ezra was the successor of Cyrus, to whom the enemies of the Jews accused them and appealed for a reversal of Cyrus' favorable decrees with respect to them. So he must be Cambyses, who is also known in the history as Axaris. This name is again similar to Xerxes, and therefore it is logical that its transliteration should again be Ahasuerus. That leaves us only with the question of who is the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther. The first clue that we have is that he reigned over 127 provinces. Only the last three kings of Persia listed above would qualify as having ruled over such an extensive empire. Another clue that we have is that the name of this king's character, the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther, was somewhat vicious and tyrannical. This is shown by how he treated his first queen, Vashti, by how unauthorized entrants into his throne room were dealt with, and by how he was on the slightest accusation prepared to deal with the whole Jewish race. In this, he perfectly conforms to the known historical character of Xerxes. It is this king, Xerxes, who is the Ahasuerus that we will be studying. There are other factors to consider as well. Darius, Hystaspes' wife, was Cyrus' daughter, and he would hardly have divorced the woman through whom he had his claim to the throne. Similarly, we can discount the claim of Artaxerxes Longimanus to be the Ahasuerus we are seeking to identify. For of him, we are told the following episode from the book of Ezra. Ezra chapter 7, verse 1, verses 6 and 7, and verses 11 through 23. Now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, this Ezra went up from Babylon, and the king granted him all his requests, according to the hand of the Lord, his God, upon him. And there went up some of the children of Israel, and of the priests, and of the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the Nethinims, unto Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king. Now this is the copy of the letter that the king Artaxerxes gave unto Ezra the priest, the scribe, even a scribe of the words of the commandments of the Lord, and of the statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, unto Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace, and at such a time, I made a decree that all they of the people of Israel, and of his priests and Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with thee. For as much as thou art sent of the king, and of his queen, and of his seven counselors, to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of thy God, which is in thine hand, and to carry the silver and gold, which the king and his counselors have freely offered unto the God of Israel, whose habitation is in Jerusalem, and all the silver and gold that thou canst find in all the province of Babylon, with the freewill offering of the people and of the priests, offering willingly for the house of their God which is in Jerusalem, that thou mayest buy speedily with this money bullocks, rams, lambs, with their meat offerings, and their drink offerings, and offer them upon the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. And whatsoever shall seem good to thee and to thy brethren, to do with the rest of the silver and the gold, that do after the will of your God. The vessels also that are given thee for the service of the house of thy God, those deliver thou before the God of Jerusalem. And whatsoever more shall be needful for the house of thy God, which thou shalt have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house. And I, even I, Artaxerxes the king, do make a decree to all the treasurers which are beyond the river, that whatsoever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of God of heaven, shall require of you, it be done speedily unto 100 talents of silver, and to 100 measures of wheat, and to 100 baths of wine, and to 100 baths of oil, and salt without prescribing how much. Whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? King Artaxerxes makes this extremely favorable and generous decree to the Jews in the 7th month of his reign. He can hardly be the Artaxerxes of the book of Esther, who in the 12th year of his reign acts like he knows nothing of the Jews and gives them over to indiscriminate slaughter on the flimsiest pretext. And we will continue this reading next time.